time and time again.
Disc 7.
Funny how the other man disappeared like that, she mused. They got all the rest. Rounded up 5 of them besides the dead chap. What did it say in the papers? Big fellow. Over 6 feet. Moustache and sideburns. In his 30s. You'd have thought he'd stand out like a sore thumb. All the others were skinny, pasty-faced kids. That Princip boy who got shot was only 19. You'd have thought a 6-foot Serbian would be easy enough to spot.
Well, of course, he's only a Serbian when he opens his mouth. Otherwise, he could be any big chap with whiskers. Could be me.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Something tells me you wouldn't have missed.
The miles had rolled away as they chatted, and quite soon their train was pulling into Zagreb station.
Now then, Bernadette said, getting up. We must both change trains for the Vienna Express, but I don't want you to help me.
Really?
No. What's more, I don't think we should travel together from now on.
Oh, Stanton said, and he didn't try to disguise his disappointment. I'd rather hoped we might.
You see, the thing is, Bernadette went on, I don't want you to get bored with me. People do sometimes. I'm quite intense.
I don't think so.
We also have to consider the possibility that I might get bored of you.
Well, that's blunt.
Look, Hugh, we've just spent nearly 5 rather lovely hours together. There's 90 minutes to be spent in the waiting room at Zagreb, then a further half day on the train to Vienna, into which we get rather late. That would make almost 20 hours together, which is quite a lot for new acquaintances. And you see, I want us to have something left to talk about, because...
Because what?
She was blushing again, more deeply than ever. Her milk-white cheeks were crimson. She took a deep breath.
All right, here we go. It'll be past 10 in the evening in Vienna, and we'll both have to find a hotel, and it seems to me that it would be cosier and certainly more economical if we roomed together. There, I've said it. What do you think?
Stanton didn't even reply. He was too taken aback. He'd known that things might drift that way. A man and a woman getting a little tipsy together over lunch always might end up in bed together. It was the bluntness that took him aback. It would have been bold even in 2024.
To be frank, Bernadette went on quickly, I've been thinking about it ever since you said that thing about women holding up half the sky. I have never in my whole life heard anyone say anything remotely so lovely or so true. Quite honestly, I think I'd want to sleep with any man who came up with it, even if he wasn't such a dish.
Stanton had never before had cause to be grateful to the memory of Chairman Mao Tse-tung, but he was now. Chapter 26. True to her word, Bernadette sat apart from Stanton in the waiting room at Zagreb and found a different carriage to him on the Vienna train. Even when they both sat for supper in the dining car, she merely raised a glass to him from across the carriage. Stanton was impressed. She was right, really. It had been obvious from almost the first moment of their conversation that there was a strong mutual attraction, and this had been reinforced over a very long lunch. There had been a palpable electricity between them, an excitement that might perhaps have been difficult to maintain over a further 11 hours of close proximity. It would probably have been all right, but then again, it could easily not have been. By arranging things as she had, Bernadette had certainly ensured that there would be a new and highly charged frisson to their encounter when they met in Vienna. She was, as his old army mates would have put it, a classy chick. Eventually, as night fell across Europe, he drifted off to sleep in his seat and didn't wake up until the train was approaching Vienna. When he got off the train, he found that Bernadette, who had been in a more forward carriage, had already secured a porter and was waiting for him beyond the barrier.
"Share a taxi?" she said brightly. "You can shove your stuff on top of mine if you like, although you'd probably better handle the emotional baggage yourself. Wouldn't want anyone prying into that, would we?"
"Thanks. I'll hang on to my actual bags as well, in fact," Stanton replied. "Old habit."
"Suit yourself. Had you thought about where you're staying?"
"Well, I'd heard the Hotel Sacher was very good. It's next to the Opera House, which sounds pretty grand, but when in Vienna, hey?"
"How extraordinary! That's where I'm staying myself."
There wasn't much of a queue for cabs, and soon they were on their way through the deserted streets.
"Not a soul about. Never is after dark," Bernadette remarked. "Lovely town in the day, but dull as paint at night. The Viennese have to go to bed at 10, did you know? Or they get fined."
"Come on, really? Fined?" Stanton replied. "Can't quite believe that."
"Well, as good as. They all live in apartment blocks, you see, and they have to pay a fee to the doorman if they're late, so they all scurry home. Ridiculous. Rushing their dinners, for which they'll have paid 20 krona in order to save a handful of heller on the night doorman. Stupid, isn't it?"
"You seem to know a bit about the place, Bernie."
"I spent a month here as companion to an aunt when I was 18. She loved her opera, which I don't much. But I loved Vienna, and I still do. I was also here 3 years ago for a conference on women's health. It's the most relaxed capital I've ever been in. They go to bed early and rise late, and when they do get up, most of them seem to just sit in coffee houses and talk about theatre. You've no idea how many different ways of making coffee they have, one for nearly every hour of the day. I think the fact that it's such an old, old capital, and it used to be important but isn't much anymore, has made it more relaxed. I mean, if you go to London or Berlin, everybody's so busy, what with us trying to stay ahead and the Germans trying to catch up. From what I've heard, New York's more frantic still. Even Paris tries to look important in a superior kind of way. But Vienna, well, it's sort of given up, hasn't it? They know they've got a motley sort of half-baked empire and an ancient emperor who's more concerned with court etiquette than international politics, so they've stopped bothering, which gives the place a nice, easy feel. Have you heard of Karl Kraus?"
Amazingly, he had. He'd studied the Austro-Hungarian Empire at university, under McCluskey, in fact, and was aware of Vienna's famous satirist.
"Publishes a magazine, doesn't he?"
"The Torch?"
"Well done! You really are the best informed soldier I've ever met. Anyway, he said, in Berlin, things are serious, but not hopeless. In Vienna, they're hopeless, but not serious. Good one, don't you think?"
Bernadette continued to chat slightly frantically, pointing out buildings and parks as the Daimler taxicab roared through the beautiful town, until quite suddenly they arrived at the Hotel Sacher.
"I suppose you think I've prattled on a bit," she said, as Stanton settled the fare.
"Well, yes," he conceded, "but it's been interesting."
"To tell you the truth, I'm a bit nervous. I expect you think I'm pretty fast, but I don't normally do this sort of thing at all."
"No, nor me."
"It was the wine that started it, and that Manhattan. Still, we're in it now, hey?"
They went into the foyer of the hotel and approached reception.
"Can you do it?" Bernadette said. "I know I'll go bright red."
"Of course." "You're sure you want to do this? I mean, just book one room?"
"Yes. I've crept along the occasional corridor in my time, and I don't like it. You feel like a thief."
"Okay.
okay?
American expression. I meant, fine.
Right. Well, off you go then.
Stanton was surprised to discover, as he approached reception, that he felt quite nervous too, even a little embarrassed. It was a strange sensation. He was, after all, a mature man, a soldier. He had carried out clandestine operations in numerous countries, and even more impressively, in two separate dimensions of space and time. He was heavily armed, extremely wealthy, and an impressive and commanding figure by any standards. James Bond himself would have been hard put to notch up any more cool points. So why was it that walking towards that reception desk, he felt 17 years old again? Perhaps it was the man behind it. Tall, thin, grey-haired, with a neat goatee beard. Like one of those old cartoons of Uncle Sam, but without the benign twinkle. He looked like a schoolmaster who was about to tell Stanton off for having dirty pictures in his bag. And it was a slightly sensitive situation, after all. Stanton knew enough about the period to be aware that no respectable hotel would allow an unmarried couple to share a room, and also that for foreign guests they would probably require some form of official identification on check-in. On the other hand, people must have had affairs in those days, as they always have done, and they must have had them somewhere.
"Good evening," Stanton said loudly. "Do you speak English? If not, perhaps you'd be kind enough to find me someone who does."
He decided not to admit that he spoke German. If they wanted to try and argue with him, he'd make it as difficult for them as possible.
"I speak English, sir, of course," Uncle Sam replied. "Do you wish to secure a room?"
"Yes, my wife and I are just off the Zagreb train. Would have wired ahead, but nobody at the Zagreb station telegraph office spoke English, if you can credit it. We want your best room, a bottle of hock, make sure it's good and chilled, and something to eat. Cheese and cold cuts will be fine."
"Of course, sir. If I might just see your papers."
"Here's mine, but my wife's are right at the bottom of her bag. I'm sure one will be sufficient."
He laid his Foreign Office letter down on the reception desk, with its GR lion and unicorn stamp uppermost, placing underneath it a 10-kroner note for good measure.
"Look here. Somebody has left this money. You take it. Perhaps it won't be claimed."
The receptionist took the money, and Stanton took the key. As he and Bernadette were escorted to the lift by the bellboy, she whispered,
"I feel like I'm 17.
"I was just thinking the same thing," Stanton replied.
"Did you really bribe him?"
"Yes. And if that hadn't worked, I was going to shoot him."
Their room had a balcony, and while the porter set out their bags, they went and stood on it and looked out over the city, just as Stanton had done in Istanbul. Except that this time, he was no longer alone. There was a near full moon, and the whole of the venerable town was washed with silver. Bernadette leant her shoulder against his.
"Is this the first time you've been alone with a woman?" she said. "I mean, since..."
She didn't finish her sentence.
"Yes. As a matter of fact, it is," Stanton admitted. "If you mean, as in, alone, alone. I did spend a lot of this year as the guest of my old professor at Cambridge, but she was very large and old, and we only talked about history."
"You had a female professor? At Cambridge? How did you manage that?"
"His wife, I mean. An old professor's wife. Took pity on me because I was on my own."
Bernadette moved a little closer still.
"Well, it's very nice. For me, I mean. Flattering, in a way. Or does that sound wrong?"
"No, it sounds fine."
There was a knock at the door, and their supper arrived. The waiter wanted to make a fuss of laying out the table with crisp cloth and silver service, but Stanton stuck a tip in his pocket and ushered him out of the room.
"Shall we have it on the balcony?" he said, picking up the tray. "It's a warm night."
They settled themselves in the chairs, and Bernadette smoked a cheroot.
"I took them up because my father said he couldn't bear to see a woman smoke. Now I can't do without them. Care for one?"
"No, I gave them up."
"Goodness gracious, why ever did you do that? I love it."
"You should give up too," he said. "They're carcinogenic."
"What?"
"They cause cancer of the lungs."
"Oh, that's all rot. My doctor says smoking actually wards off some infections, as does a nice glass of wine, by the way."
Stanton realized that he'd neglected to pour the wine and now found that in his eagerness to get rid of the waiter, he hadn't allowed him to draw the cork.
"Be prepared's my motto," he said, getting a multi-tool knife from his bag. "Once a Boy Scout, always a Boy Scout, eh?"
"Boy Scout? What? Did you join when you were 30? They only started 6 or 7 years ago. My youngest brother was one of the first."
"I just meant..." "Oh, I don't know what I meant."
"Useful bit of kit,"
Bernadette remarked, eyeing his multi-tool.
"Yes. Australian.
Cheers."
He handed her a glass, and they drank their wine in silence for a moment.
"Good hock," Stanton said.
"Yes. I love German wine. Always sweeter than French."
Stanton breathed in her smoke. It smelt delicious.
"And you?"
he inquired.
"Any adventures since Budapest? I rather got the impression that you had a thing in Budapest."
"Yes, I did. I had a thing. And no, I haven't had a thing since. But then it had only been 3 months."
"Did he break your heart?"
She looked thoughtful for a moment.
"Well, shall we say, I got my heart broken."
"Thought so."
"But..."
"But?"
"All right," she said, looking him in the eye. "How about this? She wasn't a he."
"Oh, right. So it was a woman who broke your heart."
"Are you terribly shocked and disgusted?"
"Christ, no. I mean, no. Why would I be?"
"Why would you be?"
Bernadette was very surprised.
"Because that sort of thing is generally thought to be pretty shocking and disgusting, I should say."
"Do you want me to be shocked and disgusted?"
"No, certainly not."
"Well, good. Because I'm not."
"Really?"
Stanton wondered where to begin.
"Look, I know that society currently entertains a lot of prejudice when it comes to gay sex, but..."
"Gay? What's the fact that it was gay got to do with it? And anyway, it wasn't gay. It was desperate and strange and intense and... well, it certainly wasn't gay. In fact, it was really quite miserable. But I suppose that's what you get for developing a crush on an extremely serious Hungarian feminist."
"Sorry. I didn't mean gay, obviously. Wrong word entirely. Can't think why I said it. I was just saying that obviously I understand that same-sex love is frowned on at the moment."
"Frowned on? At the moment?"
"Well, you know, I'm sure attitudes will change."
"Really? I admire your optimism, but I can't imagine why you'd think that. For me, it was a bit of a dalliance. A surprise, really. Like a holiday romance. But I know quite a few people who choose to live that life exclusively, and I can assure you that society makes things very hard for them indeed."
"I'm sure it does," Stanton replied. "But personally, I don't believe a person chooses their sexual preferences at all. To me, it's self-evident that they were born with them.
And I feel very strongly that nobody should be discriminated against on the grounds of their sexuality.
Bernadette leant across the table and took his hand.
Hugh, that's a wonderful thing to say. An amazing thing to say. Where do you come up with this stuff? Nobody should be discriminated against on the grounds of their sexuality. Hang on while I write it down.
She went back into the room. It seemed to take her rather a long time to write down a single sentence, and when she returned, she was in her underwear.
Am I being awful?
She asked.
It's just that you're so interesting. I thought that if we weren't careful, we might end up sitting out here talking all night and never... well, never go inside.
Even in the moonlight, he could see that once more she was blushing deeply. But the funny thing was, Stanton couldn't actually see any more of her now than he had done before. Her underwear covered pretty much the same parts of her as had her ankle-length hobble skirt, apart from a slightly lower neckline and her bare arms. She was wearing a long white slip, gathered slightly at the waist and tapering in again towards the ankle. Curiously, despite the modesty of the garment, Stanton found it incredibly erotic. Perhaps it was the moonlight on her bare white arms. When it came to the sensual power of glimpses of flesh, less could certainly be more. Something the lingerie designers of his century had long since forgotten. He got up, took her hand, and they went back inside the room together and turned out the lamps. Then, with the moonlight streaming through the open balcony doors, he stepped towards her and lifted off her slip. The intensity of the moment was quite overpowering. Not only was it the first time he had been with anyone but Cassie in almost 10 years, but this woman was from another time. 1914. In the Vienna moonlight. He stepped back from her while removing the stud from his starched collar. She was completely naked, save for her silk stockings, which were secured above the knee, not with suspenders, but with garters. That, however, was not what caught his attention, nor was it her delightful bosom, larger than he expected, but firm, or the curve of her waist, or the slight bulge of her belly, deeply stirring though all those things were. It was the pubic hair. There was just more of it than he'd expected. Sandy pale, full and curly, even spreading a little beyond what would one day be known as the bikini line. He should have been expecting it. He knew about female pubic hair, but he had never encountered it in its natural state. Cassie had waxed. All the girls he'd ever been with had either waxed or shaved, not necessarily the full Brazilian, but certainly a major trim. He recalled the famous story of the poet Ruskin, who it was said could not consummate his marriage because he was so shocked and disgusted by his wife's pubic hair. Stanton wasn't shocked. He just wasn't used to it, that was all. In fact, he thought it looked lovely.
"Well, are you going to take your shirt off or not?"
Bernadette inquired.
"I'm beginning to feel a bit silly standing here."
"Sorry." "Yes," he said, beginning quickly to undress.
They collapsed together on the bed and began to make love. For a few moments, Stanton was consumed with a hungry passion as he gnawed and pawed at Bernadette's squirming body. It had been well over a year since he'd had sex, and this sudden cessation of the drought had brought every nerve in his being to a state of urgent arousal. She too had abandoned herself to primal instinct and wriggled and writhed against him in his embrace, plunging a hand down to grasp away at him.
"Goodness," she gasped, "I have missed these."
She was very different to Cassie, who had been more passive, happier to go with the flow. Like any couple who shared a bed exclusively with each other, they'd fallen into habits together. Happily enough, but nonetheless, he found the thrill of a new and unexplored body and a proactively different approach fiercely erotic. And that nearly ruined the whole thing. Thinking about Cassie. Comparing Bernadette to her. His wife. The undisputed love of his life and mother of his children. A surge of guilt swept over him, almost as if Cassie were in the room and had caught him at it. He could feel the passion dissipating, even as Bernadette chewed hungrily at his mouth. That unwelcome thought. That distraction. A woman could fake it, ignore it till it went away. But with a man, the evidence was on display. In Bernadette's hand.
"Oh," she said. "Did I do something wrong?"
This was absurd. He wanted this. He needed it. And he had every right to it. And the ridiculous thing was, he knew Cassie would agree. Of course she would. Cassie. Cassie. How could he get her to leave the room, to pop next door, retire to the balcony? He thought about Bernadette naked, about her revealing herself as she pulled her long slip up her body, her shapely legs clad in white silk. He thought about her pubic hair, lush and womanly, strawberry blonde, beautiful and actually appropriate. He put his hand down to touch her. It was so strange. He was used to things being smooth or stubbly, depending on the level of maintenance. But this was soft, warm and giving. Luxuriant. Fascinating. He wanted to plunge his whole being deep inside.
"That's better," Bernadette gasped. "Now we're getting somewhere."
Afterwards, they lay together and finished off the wine, and Bernadette smoked and snuggled in his arms.
"That was very nice," she said,
stretching a leg across his body. "Yes. Yes, it was," Stanton agreed.
"You didn't leave any seed in me, did you?" she asked. "Bit late to ask, really, but did you?"
"I don't think so. I tried to be careful," he replied. "I think it's all over your tummy and the sheets."
"Good. Better out than in, say I."
Stanton thought how very strange an idea it would be if he did get a girl pregnant in this new version of the century. To have children in two separate dimensions of space and time was a mind-boggling thought. A thought which brought Tessa and Bill to mind, his children, who had been his whole life, who were still his whole life, except that they were gone. And he was in bed with a woman who had died decades before they were born. Bernadette must have sensed the progress of his thoughts.
"You don't feel guilty, do you?" she asked. "About your wife, I mean. I'm sure she'd understand. Or is that presumptuous of me? Of course, I don't know what she'd think, obviously, but she would understand, wouldn't she? She wouldn't want you to be alone all the time."
"Yes, I think she'd understand," Stanton said. "And no, I don't feel guilty."
She put her head on his shoulder and kissed his neck. He put his arm around her, and they lay together for a while. By craning his chin hard against his chest, he could just see her face in the moonlight. It was such a sweet, sweet face. But now the pretty upturned nose wrinkled a little. She was puzzled. "Something up?" he asked.
"I thought your watch had stopped," she said,
twisting her head so that she could look at it.
"But it hasn't. See, the second hand's spinning away, I can see the luminous hand.
So what?
Well, it isn't ticking. Your wristwatch doesn't tick, she said. That's very strange.
Oh, it does. Just very quietly, he assured her.
No, it doesn't, she insisted. I had it right against my ear, and I have very good hearing, and it doesn't tick.
It's a specialist piece. Very advanced mechanism. Swiss.
Seiko. Doesn't sound very Swiss.
They're a very small firm. Very advanced. Years ahead of their time. I do sensitive work. I have to make sure I have the best equipment.
Which brings us to the point, actually. What do you do?
She asked, rolling onto her front, raising her head up and putting her chin on her hands.
You are a strange, and I must say rather intriguing man. You claim to be a soldier.
Claim? What do you mean, claim?
But you're also a gold miner from the Australian wilderness. Yet you've not only heard of Karl Kraus, but you can name his satirical magazine, which is published only in Vienna, and which, by the way, you could read in German. You hold the most astonishingly enlightened views on women and on sex I've ever heard, and you have such a lovely turn of phrase that some of the things you say should be in a dictionary of quotations. You claim to have studied at Cambridge, but didn't seem to remember that they don't have female students, let alone female professors. What's more, you are as physically fit as any man I've ever met. Fitter, in fact. Your muscles are like iron, which is, incidentally, most attractive to embrace. And so far, I've noted two scars on your person, which I think may be bullet scars. You never let those two bags of yours out of your sight, and you have a watch that does not tick. Not even the tiniest bit. Who are you, Hugh Stanton? And, honestly, what do you do?
Well, I could tell you, he said, remembering an old line from his own century. But I'd have to kill you. She smiled.
I hope you're joking.
Are you a spy, then? I'm just a stranger on a train, Bernie. We both are.
A stranger on a train, she repeated slowly. That does sound romantic.
It is romantic. For me, anyway. I can't think of many things more romantic than bumping into a beautiful girl on the Sarajevo to Zagreb express and then spending a night with her in a moonlit hotel room in Vienna. Just a night. He didn't answer for a moment. Could he stay? For a little while? Have breakfast on their balcony and then stroll about the city all day and in the evening wine and dine and perhaps even dance? This was Imperial Vienna, after all. And then, at the end of the evening, return to this very room with Bernadette and... But he had his mission and he had his secrets. So many secrets. And this woman was very clever and observant and inquisitive. I think perhaps just one night is for the best, don't you? He answered.
I suppose, perhaps, she said, but very sadly. I think if we made it two, I might just fall in love with you, and I don't think I'm very good at love.
Anybody can be good at love. You just have to find the right person.
Did you love your wife a lot?
Yes. I loved her a lot.
I'm sure she deserved it.
She did.
So, I just need to find the right person then?
Yes, that's all.
Not a Hungarian feminist?
Not by the sound of it.
Or a mysterious stranger on a train? Her chin was still in her hands, and she was looking at him. The moon was behind her, casting her into silhouette, but he could feel her eyes. Best to avoid them too, you think? All I know is that I don't really feel I have anything to offer anybody at the moment. And to be quite frank, I rather doubt I ever will.
Emotional baggage?
Yes. Emotional baggage. Rather well-travelled baggage.
What will you do in the morning, I mean, when I'm tossed aside like a soiled glove and left to skulk out of the hotel alone, forlornly trying to hide my shame?
I have an appointment in Berlin.
You see? Appointment in Berlin. That sounds exactly like a spy novel.
Oh, it's nothing very exciting. Not as exciting as chaining yourself to the railings outside Buckingham Palace.
That's not exciting at all. It's embarrassing and terrifying and horribly uncomfortable. You've no idea the hatred we provoke. People jeer and spit. Women too. And the police are horrible. It's as if they feel threatened. How can a woman chained to a railing be threatening?
You'll win in the end, you know. One day, sex discrimination will actually be illegal.
Sex discrimination? Wonderful phrase. Let's hope you're a prophet. After all, women do hold up half the sky. Anyway, I think we should forget the future and concentrate on the present. If this is to be our only night together, then I think we should make the most of it.
And so they made love again, and afterwards lay in the dark once more, and Bernadette smoked another cigarette, and Stanton wished he could share it with her. He didn't, though. He was having enough trouble keeping the tryst from being a ménage à trois as it was, without giving Cassie an excuse to appear by the bedside table and tell him that Tessa had brought another leaflet home from school with a rotting lung on it.
"I envy you going to Berlin," she said. "I'd like to go one day. I want to meet Rosa Luxemburg more than anyone in the world. Have you heard of her? I doubt there's many Englishmen who have, but you seem so terribly well-informed in general."
"I most certainly have heard of her. Marxist economist and extreme irritant to the German establishment," Stanton replied. He was about to add, "eventually organized a German revolution and sadly ended up beaten to death in the street by a paramilitary murder squad," before remembering that those things wouldn't happen for years yet, and hopefully now never would.
"You are amazing," Bernadette said with delight. "I cannot believe you. How many British soldiers have heard of Rosa Luxemburg? Only one, I bet, in the whole world. And I've just made love to him."
She kissed him hard and passionately. Stanton smiled to himself. He'd always known his history degree would come in handy for something.
"She's a wonderful woman, you know," Bernadette said thoughtfully. "I can't think of anyone I admire so much. Very clever, very passionate, very brave and very important."
Then, a little while after that, he fell asleep. The first time in so very long that he had fallen asleep with a woman's heart beating nearby. And as he drifted into dreams, he was astonished to realize that he was happy. Happy in that moment. Happy lying naked with Bernadette Burdett.
Chapter 27. When he woke up, perhaps an hour later, Bernadette wasn't in bed anymore. She had put her slip back on and was at the table in the sitting room part of the room, where the porter had put Stanton's bags. For a moment, as his consciousness surfaced, Stanton thought it was Cassie. He'd seen her sitting just that way so often, in the darkness, in her nightie. When she'd had some pressing work or study to do and had crept out of bed in the night to do it, and he'd awoken and seen her at the table across the room, her face a kind of monochrome grey-silver, illuminated by the light from her computer. But it wasn't Cassie. It was Bernadette's face that was turned grey-silver, illuminated by the light from a computer. He was out of bed in a second, but she was equally quick, and he found that he was staring down the barrel of his own Glock semi-automatic. It had been in his bag, alongside the computer, which was concealed within a false book, the bag from which he'd got the multi-tool with a corkscrew to open the bottle of Hock.
"For Christ's sake, what are you doing?"
he said.
"I beg your pardon,"
she replied, seeming genuinely surprised at what to her must have been an unfamiliar profanity.
"I said, what are you doing? Put that down! Why did you look in my bag? Christ, Bernie, put that gun down!"
She didn't put it down, but continued instead to point it with steady hand at his head.
"I got up in the night," she said, "and I wanted something to read, and your bag was open, and I spotted a book in it. And I wondered what a strange man like you reads to amuse himself. I know it's wrong to pry, but I'm a girl and I couldn't help it, and when I opened the book, I found an even stranger thing."
He hadn't locked his bag. The wine and the moonlight had got the better of him. He'd meant to relock it, but then she'd started undressing, and now a woman born in the 1880s had come into contact with a state-of-the-art 21st century computer that would have looked like something out of science fiction in the 1980s.
"Look, Bernie," he began, that's a sort of light box. It's to do with photography. It's a kind of portable developing room. It's a secret invention, but nothing very mysterious, just small and compact, that's all."
He took a step towards her.
"Don't move, Hugh!"
she barked, levelling the gun in front of her eyes and taking aim between his.
"Bernie, what is this? You kind of guessed I was a spy. And you were right. I'm a sort of agent. I have equipment. Secret equipment. I touched your photographic light box,"
she interrupted.
"And I don't understand it, and I think it's very strange and, quite frankly, rather scary, but not half as scary as the image that appeared on it."
Stanton went cold. He remembered what had been on the screen the last time he had used his computer, in Sarajevo, on the previous morning. Another imbecilic lapse of judgment. Why hadn't he quit out of the program? Why hadn't he shut down?
"Now look, Bernie," he began.
"It was a map, Hugh. A map of Sarajevo. The Letin Bridge area of Sarajevo on the north bank of the Miljatska. And the route of the Archduke's motorcade was marked on it,
Bernie.
As were the positions of the would-be assassins and of the two assassination attempts."
"I know, but
how did they describe the missing man, Hugh? 6 feet tall and a moustache? It could have been anyone. You said it on the train, didn't you? It could have been you. Except that the man was Serbian. But was he? Perhaps he was an Englishman who could speak Serbian, or even a Serbian who can speak wonderful, intriguing English. What did it say in the papers about the gun, Hugh? That the bullet that killed Princip came from an unknown type?"
She waved the gun in front of his face.
"I'm a country girl. I've been around guns and pistols all my life, and I have never seen one like this before. And I've never heard of Glock, either. Quite frankly, I can't think what this thing is even made of. More secret equipment. Perhaps secret Serbian equipment. You may be a spy, Hugh, but you're also an assassin. And the only thing that stopped you doing something that could have destroyed Europe is that you killed the wrong man. Your own man."
There were tears in her eyes, but despite that, her hand was steady and her expression resolved.
"Give me my gun back, Bernie," Stanton said.
"Not likely. I'm arresting you, Hugh. I know it sounds ridiculous considering how we've spent the last few hours, but I'm going to turn you in. I'm sorry, but I have to do it, because you are a terribly dangerous man, and if you resist, I shall shoot. I may not recognise the gun, but I know a trigger when I see one.
You can't shoot a naked man, Bernie. It's not cricket.
I damn well can, and I will.
Not with a safety catch on, you can't. Her eyes flicked down, and in that instant he strode forward and grabbed the gun from her with one hand while putting the other over her mouth just before it could let out a scream. That same mouth which had so charmed him with its smile when they'd met on the train. The mouth which he had been kissing so ferociously just an hour before, and which had been kissing him. The pace of life in his new world was certainly picking up. "Now listen to me very carefully, because you've made a big mistake," he said calmly. "No, don't struggle. I very much don't want to hurt you, because although I've only known you for a day, I am already very fond of you. So please stop wriggling about and listen to me. I didn't kill the wrong man, Bernie. I killed the right man. Remember what you said to me on the train? That you didn't think I was the sort of person who'd miss. Well, you're right. I'm not. I was in Sarajevo to stop an assassination, not commit one. And that's exactly what I did. I killed Gavrilo Princip before he could kill Franz Ferdinand. And yes, I am a British soldier, as I've told you, but I've been seconded from the army for a very special mission. A highly unofficial mission. You see, some very influential people in Britain knew about the Serbian plans to attack the Austrian royal family, but of course they couldn't send an agent to stop them. Not officially. Officially, Britain has no spies and does not involve itself in espionage. A British citizen operating on behalf of his government in Bosnia would have been a serious breach of Austrian sovereignty, which could in fact have resulted in a crisis all of its own. So I was given leave from the army and sent in as a civilian to stop these people from carrying out their plan. As he spoke, Stanton couldn't help reflect on the fact that every single word he was saying was entirely true. The only lie was one of omission, in that he had neglected to add that he'd been sent across 111 years of time to do it. You see, my controllers in Britain could see exactly what you could see, what any sensible person could see. That if the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire was killed by Serbs, there'd be a real possibility of European war. Global war, in fact. But it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because I shot Princip. She'd stopped wriggling and had been listening intently, her eyes growing wider with every word he said. Stanton tentatively removed his hand from her mouth. She didn't scream. Then Stanton remembered that he was naked and felt rather stupid. "If I just put my trousers on, can I trust you not to scream?" he said. Bernadette nodded, but she clearly still had doubts. "The British government wouldn't have needed to send their own spy," she said. "If they knew about the plot, why didn't they just warn the Austrians and let them protect the Duke?" Stanton could think of two very good reasons for that. "Well, first of all, it might easily not have worked. Britain is linked with Russia in the Triple Entente, remember, and Russia backs the Serbs. The Austrian military is paranoid about Russia, and with good reason, because only last year it turned out their own spy chief was a Russian mole." "Mole?" "It means double agent. Did you ever read about the Alfred Radl scandal?" Stanton had come across this catastrophe for Austrian intelligence during his preparatory research. The previous year, Radl, Austria's chief of military intelligence, had been discovered selling his own country's entire battle plan to the Russians because he needed money to support his lover, who was a fellow officer.
Yes, I read about it,
Bernadette admitted.
Pretty fruity stuff.
Well, because of Radel, the Austrians have been fed misinformation by the Russians on a continuous basis since 1903, so they would very likely view information supplied by a Russian ally as deliberate misinformation.
It's a dark game, isn't it?
Bernadette admitted.
You haven't heard the half of it. Consider this for dark. It's perfectly possible that even if the Austrians had believed a British warning about the Sarajevo plot, they might have let it go ahead anyway.
Go ahead? Let anarchists murder their own crown prince? Think about it. This is a crown prince who married for love, against the emperor's violent objections. So violent, in fact, that he instructed the Austrian court to ostracize the woman and officially disinherited any children she had with Franz Ferdinand. Add to that the fact that most of the Austrian elite have been itching for an excuse to put Serbia in its place. In fact, Franz Ferdinand was one of the few doves. The emperor was a hawk.
Bernadette leant forward and squeezed his hand.
Doves and hawks. God, I love the way you talk, Hugh.
So you believe me then?
Yes. Yes, I blooming well do. But do you really think the old emperor might actually have wanted his nephew dead because his wife wasn't posh enough?
Power is a dirty game, Bernie. A very dirty game.
Stanton would have liked to show her how true this was. To tell her that in the previous history of the world, on hearing of his nephew's death, the emperor had actually expressed relief about it. That he was recorded as having said, "A higher power has re-established the order which, alas, I could not preserve." That would have given her something to get wide-eyed about. The old man had thought God himself shot Franz Ferdinand to preserve the integrity of the Habsburg dynasty.
"So you see," he went on, "the only way to be absolutely sure the plot would fail was to prevent it ourselves. I was recruited to do the job by a group centred around Trinity College, Cambridge, dedicated to preserving international peace. They call themselves the Companions of Kronos."
"The God of Time?"
"Yes, because time was running out to stop Europe from destroying itself."
Bernadette was silent for a moment.
"Well, it certainly makes more sense than you being a pan-Serbian nationalist," she said. "Well done, by the way. I mean, on pulling it off."
"I'd hoped to do it without having to kill Princip, and particularly that poor girl he was with, but he was in the act of pulling his gun when I arrived."
"You had no choice."
"No, I don't think I did."
"Amazing that you were there at all. The paper said it was a mix-up and the car took the wrong turn. It's almost as if you knew."
"One develops a nose for these things in my game."
"A sort of sixth sense."
"Something like that, yes."
"Well, you did really, really well."
"Thanks."
There was another pause during which Stanton took the opportunity to shut and stow his photographic light box.
"Enough to make a girl swoon,"
Bernadette went on. "I find I often have that effect."
"Are all spies as devilishly attractive as you?"
"Good God, no. I'm far and away the sexiest."
"Sexiest? Another rather splendid word. Where do you get them from?"
"It's a gift." Bernadette got up from the table and began once more to remove her slip.
Chapter 28. The following morning, Bernadette and Stanton parted company, and he continued his journey to Berlin, imperial capital of the Second Reich, and the place where he knew he must kill the emperor. Berlin was two cities. That was the conclusion Stanton came to as he ate a dish of ice cream on the terrace of the Kranzler Patisserie on Unter den Linden. One was 19th century, and the other 20th century.
The 19th century one was about as 19th century a city as you could find, steeped in the imperialist mindset of the time. A fiercely militaristic town, capital of the garrison state of Prussia. No people since the Spartans had so gloried in martial ardour. No nation of the modern world, with the possible exception of the Zulus, ever idolised its army so completely. The army was far and away the most important and the most visible institution in the city after the monarchy, with which it was inextricably linked. The military were everywhere. Marching bands in every park. Grand parades on every Sunday, and any other day on the tiniest excuse. Officers strutting in the boulevards and lounging in the cafes in ornate dress uniforms, which would have been entirely impractical for any other activity than raising a glass or bowing to a lady. Columns of troops marched about wherever there was space to march about, and there were sentries everywhere. Stanton had had no idea of the number of soldiers on the streets of pre-war Imperial Berlin. It was frankly a bit weird. No other city felt the need to place uniformed sentries outside every public building. Museums were guarded, national monuments, railway stations, public toilets. Anywhere that crown or municipal authority was extended, there was a spike-headed soldier with a rifle at his shoulder marching about, usually with the ubiquitous black-and-white sentry box behind him. To a military man like Stanton, it was all quite fun. He enjoyed the sight of their impeccable turnout, their faultless drill and the shine on every boot. The Germans did military ceremony almost as well as the British, and they did a lot more of it. The sort of show the Horse Guards put on outside Buckingham Palace once a day, the Reichsheer would mount at a sewage pumping station on the hour. And where there could be no soldiers, there were people trying to look like soldiers. Half the population of Berlin was in uniform, three quarters if you counted waiters and hotel doormen. Every institution in the city seemed to have been moulded in the image of the military. Everyone from policemen to postmen to students to hotel concierges dressed like soldiers. Teachers wore uniforms. And yet, strangely, Stanton found that the overall effect was neither warlike nor threatening. Rather, it gave a slightly comical impression of benign and self-satisfied permanence. The postmen that looked like captains, and the waterboard officials that looked like generals, and the telegram delivery boys that looked like field marshals were just part of a happy pantomime. As if the whole city was the set of some Ruritanian comic opera, and the people its chorus and principals. Germany hadn't fought a real war since Bismarck had unified the country 40 years before. And for all the martial music and stamping about, Stanton sensed no desire among the people of its capital city to fight one now. A cake trolley passed by Stanton's table. They really liked their cakes, the Germans. Or, perhaps more to the point, they liked their cream. For as far as Stanton could see, cakes were really no more than whipped cream delivery systems, thin layers of sponge set between inch-thick layers of dairy fat. Café und Kuchen, that was what they liked in Berlin. Stanton liked it too. The whole place just felt so contented. And of course that was because of the other Berlin, the 20th century Berlin. The Berlin whose time had come. Because, military pantomime aside, the place was modern. Even to a visitor from the 21st century it felt that way. It seemed to Stanton that there was scarcely a single building that was over 50 years old, and many more appeared only to have been built the previous week. This was a city expanding more quickly and more dynamically than any other town in the world. There was a huge amount of motor traffic, far more so than Stanton had noticed in London, and everywhere there was evidence of powerhouse industry and cutting-edge technology. On the same streets where squads of soldiers marched, There were banks of public telephones, automatic ticketing machines, and the most efficient and well-organized trams in Europe. There were elevated railway lines and underground railways with stations on almost every corner. There was electricity everywhere. The whole town was wired, and more reliably than anywhere on the planet. When Stanton plugged in his personal computer using a customized transformer, he'd found as steady a current as ever he'd had in the 21st century. Berlin made everything. Most of the world's chemicals, the bulk of the world's electrical engineering, a large chunk of the world's steel, all the world's advanced cameras, telescopes, and precision instruments, and above all, it made incredible amounts of money. Even the great cities of the industrial USA looked enviously at Berlin. Nutters aside, the last thing anybody in this city wanted was a war. War would cost it everything. It had cost it everything. The last time. Stanton had seen the pictures. Pictures of this magnificent city in ruins. Hatred and slaughter stalking the town. He knew the history. Every school kid from his time did. It was all they studied. How Germany had led the 20th century to nightmarish ruin and in so doing had destroyed itself. How these plump, busy, prosperous people would in just a few years' time be shattered ghosts, disease-ridden and on the very brink of starvation, their world-beating economy destroyed and facing decades of nightmare, revolution, deprivation and oppression. But it wasn't going to happen this time. Because Stanton was going to stop it. He would save Berlin, and he would save Germany. He would save its foolish, stamping toy soldiers, and he would save its brilliant people, whom Stanton admired so much for their industry and their inventiveness, their crazy originality, their commerce, their science, and their arts. He would save them from the terrible fate that awaited them. He would save them from their Kaiser. Because outrage in Sarajevo or not, sooner or later, Emperor Wilhelm, with his militaristic obsessions, his vanity, and his raw, wounded ego, would drag this young, dynamic nation into suicidal war. A large picture of the Emperor hung on the wall opposite, and to Stanton's mind, that picture said it all. It was cartoonish in its vainglorious swagger. The great man viewed slightly from below as if surveying the whole world and intent on being its master. Dressed in a white uniform with steel breastplate like some angel of war, a colonnaded Roman background made his imperial pretensions all the more clear. And the left arm on his sword hilt, where it usually was, disguising the birth defect which many believed had shaped the psyche of the man. It was withered and fully 6 inches shorter than his right arm. Wilhelm had always bravely ignored the disability, taking part in every sport and military practice, but nonetheless he had remained secretly prey to deep self-doubt and also a self-disgust. Stanton asked for his bill and laid some Reichmarks on the saucer. And there was the Emperor again, on the notes and coins. Kaiser Bill. The man with the pointy-up moustache. The man for whom there was still only one Germany. The military one. Because it meant nothing to Wilhelm II that German industry was conquering the world. For him, it had to be German arms that did the conquering. With him at the front in a helmet with a huge eagle on top. Stanton looked at his watch. In less than 24 hours, the Emperor would be dead. He felt a pang of pity. Wilhelm was by no means all bad, but he was vain and cantankerous and pompous and unreasonable and emotionally unstable with a well-established small empire complex.
Those were very dangerous characteristics in a person who was the undisputed warlord of the finest army on the planet. He simply had to die.
This ends Disc 7.
Time and Time Again.
Disc 8.
Chapter 29. Stanton left the cafe and walked out onto Unter den Linden, intent on one last reconnoitre of his chosen vantage point. It was a delightful morning, and the sun was shining through the linden trees and the chestnuts, making a dappled pattern on the road. Cars, carriages and pedestrians hurried up and down, and policemen waved their arms about. When Stanton had arrived in Berlin, instead of checking into a hotel, he'd taken a short-let furnished apartment. He had no idea when a suitable opportunity to carry out his mission would arise, and reckoned that he might be resident in the city for months, waiting for the perfect hit to present itself. He certainly didn't intend to rush it. After all, he would very likely get only one chance. If he failed, there was a fair possibility he would be captured. Even if he got away, the Kaiser's security people would be so spooked that it might prove impossible ever to get another opportunity. He was painfully aware that, unlike with the Sarajevo mission, he had no benefit of hindsight this time, and that apart from having superior equipment, his chances were no better than any other assassin's would have been. As it turned out, he hadn't needed to wait very long at all, because on only the third morning after he had arrived from Vienna, a royal ceremony was announced to take place in Potsdamer Platz. A glance at the published arrangements was enough to convince Stanton that his chance had arrived. He strolled along Unter den Linden and turned south into Friedrichstrasse, then onto Leipziger Strasse and into Leipziger Platz, from which he intended to take up his firing position. Leipziger Platz was adjacent to Potsdamer Platz, the heart of Imperial Berlin. This was the great transport hub of the city, across which were laid numerous tram lines. The arrival of automobiles in large numbers had placed extra pressure on the Platz, and extensive reorganization had been required. A new layout for the maze of tram tracks had been put in place, and the Kaiser himself had been persuaded to journey in from his Potsdam Palace to declare it open. This was considered a great coup for the municipal authorities, who, unlike the army, found it very difficult to persuade the Emperor to interest himself in their activities. They had therefore made a great fuss over the arrangements for the ceremony, all of which were fully described in the papers. Stanton had spent the days since the announcement had been made laying his plans. It was clear that he needed elevation to get a clear shot. The target would no doubt be on a podium, but he was likely to be surrounded by staff, and he certainly couldn't rely on the German security team being as unfathomably incompetent as the Austrian one had been in Sarajevo. Stanton only had to look at the difference in the state of the two nations' armies and economies to be clear that dealing with the Germans was going to be a very different thing from dealing with the Austro-Hungarians. Royal protection techniques and theory might have been less advanced than they were in Stanton's personal experience, but it would nonetheless be a big mistake to underestimate the German police and secret service. Fortunately for Stanton, there existed an obvious platform from which to fire. Leipziger Platz was famous for its shops and restaurants. The most famous among these was the Wertheim department store. This was a truly massive structure at the end of Leipziger Strasse, facing onto Leipziger Platz. 90 meters of shopfront towering over the plaza and offering an uninterrupted view of Potsdamer Platz beyond. And the Wertheim had a roof garden. A roof garden from which it was possible to gain access to the rest of the roof, and to which the only impediment to trespass was a sign on a small door informing the public that access was verboten. A door through which Stanton had simply stepped on the three previous days, and through which he stepped now. These truly were more innocent times.
The roof area outside the fenced area of the café garden was much like the roofs of most large buildings, a maze of chimneys, pipes, and ventilation shafts. Plenty of cover, making it possible to be completely concealed within a very few steps of leaving the café. Having made his way to the position he had selected on the edge of the roof of the Wertheim store, Stanton looked out over Potsdamer Platz far below him. The great junction was crisscrossed with trams and cars and scuttling pedestrians. Tomorrow it would be filled with cheering crowds, marching bands, and lines of policemen. And in the middle of it, his target. The vantage point simply could not have been more perfect. No sniper had ever been better served. He crept back across the roof and made his way home. That night, in his little apartment, Stanton got out his computer and attempted to write down his thoughts. The following day would be the last one when events in Europe would bear any resemblance to how they had unfolded in the previous 20th century. Preventing the Sarajevo assassination had merely put the catastrophe on hold. Europe remained a primed bomb, with the Kaiser itching to light the fuse. It was still perfectly possible for the 20th century to unfold in exactly the same disastrous manner that it had the last time. Tomorrow, all that would change. He would eliminate the root cause of conflict, and there would begin an entirely new history. One single bullet from another world would send the whole course of human events plunging into uncharted waters. And with that, his own mission, his purpose in this time and place, would be over. He would have done his duty. And what then? For the 5 weeks that he had been living in the past, he had been able to avoid that question. The business of Kronos was too pressing, his work too important. But in just a few hours, that would all be over. He wouldn't be a special agent from the future anymore. Just a lonely man prone to strange and fantastical dreams about peoples and events that had never occurred, nor would ever occur. It would be time to face life in a century yet to unfold, just like everybody else. What would he do? He stared at the blank document on the screen of his laptop. The first word he typed was Cassie. He hadn't planned it, but of course it was inevitable. Or was it? He added a question mark. Cassie? Did she have a part to play? Perhaps he really couldn't face a life without her. He wrote, Suicide? Then, almost at once, he pressed delete and watched the cursor gobble up that second word. It just wasn't an option. He was a soldier. He didn't run. Nobody was going to kill Guts Stanton, least of all himself. And the reason for that wasn't because of his old fear that there might be a heaven and hell. It was because he wanted to live. He could see that he had been given an opportunity more exciting and extraordinary than any man had ever been given in all the human story. A chance to live in a different and better age, before the world got small and boring, before man's horizon had been reduced to the parameters of a smartphone screen. He had a chance to be a part of a whole different course for humanity, to help shape it. Kronos had made him rich. He was uniquely trained, uniquely well-informed, and entirely without dependents or responsibilities. It was actually a dream come true. He pressed the delete button again. The cursor reversed backwards across the single word on his screen, erasing it one space at a time. First the question mark, then the E, then the I, the S, another S, an A, and finally the capital C. The whole word gone. Cassie gone. She would always be a part of his soul,
but she was no longer a part of his life. He was in another dimension of space and time, one in which she had never existed, nor would ever exist. It was time to begin to live again. The screen was empty once again. A blank page. As was his life. On a sudden thought, he typed, Shackleton. He could actually join him. A lifelong hero. The Great New Zealander's Antarctic expedition wouldn't leave for another 2 months. With the money Stanton had and the skills he could offer, he was certain he could get a place on board. To join Shackleton on his quest to cross the Antarctic. For a man like Stanton, that was nirvana. To do it hard. The way the real heroes used to do it. In leather and oilskin. With ropes and dogs and ship's biscuit rations and only the stars and a compass for guidance. To do things the way men did them before the 20th century ruined everything. Shackleton. He pressed underline. Shackleton. That was definitely an option. Any man in Stanton's old regiment would have given 10 lifetimes for such an opportunity. Next he wrote, Everest. Could he climb it? He'd climbed some bloody tough peaks in his time. The Matterhorn, the Eiger, why not Everest? He could be the first. The first to do it, 40 years before it had been done in the last loop of time. And without oxygen. He could be the first human being on that summit. The first living thing to touch that pristine space. Before the rubbish, the discarded food packs and old equipment, the corpses and the frozen turds, to be there when it was new. Next, he wrote, Fly the Atlantic. Lindbergh did in 27. Stanton would beat the anti-Semitic bastard. He had 13 years. He'd start by learning to fly, in a real flying machine made of wire and canvas, not a pressurized metal tube full of duty-free in-flight catering and other people. Perhaps he would somehow find a way to get back into the army. After all, he was a better-trained soldier than any other man on the planet. Perhaps one day he would ride the northwest frontier or gallop across desert kingdoms with T.E. Lawrence. Then Stanton surprised himself by typing another word. Bernadette. She'd been on his mind since the previous week in Vienna. He'd pushed the thought away through guilt about Cassie, about infidelity to a spirit, a memory. It was ridiculous. What the hell did he have to feel guilty about? He underlined the word. Bernadette. Then he closed his computer. A handful of boys' own adventures and a beautiful girl with laughing Irish eyes. That was enough dreaming for one night. He'd think about it all again the following evening, after he had finished his mission, when the future was finally his to plan. Chapter 30. The following morning, Stanton rose early, turned on his little gas ring, and made some coffee. He had no food in the flat apart from some chocolate, but he wasn't hungry. He never was on the day of a mission. Some of the guys had sworn by a big breakfast before heading in country, but Stanton always felt that hunger kept him sharp. He began a final check of his equipment. Taking out his rifle, breaking it down, inspecting it, cleaning it one last time, even though it didn't need it, then packing it away again. Next, he put on his body armor underneath his jacket. He didn't think he'd need it, but then he hadn't thought he'd need his pistol in Sarajevo, and if he hadn't had it in his pocket, Princip would undoubtedly have shot the Archduke, and Europe would be only a couple of weeks away from war. He put the Glock pistol in his pocket. Then he took from the bigger of his bags a sheaf of printed leaflets. Leaflets he had brought all the way from the 21st century. Inflammatory leaflets, coloured mainly bright red.
He put the leaflets in the smaller of his two bags beside his rifle. He was ready. He left his apartment and took the U-Bahn, descending into the clean and efficiently run transport arteries of the city, riding the spanking new, punctual to the second train, and emerging at Potsdamer Platz. The scheduled time for the royal appearance was still an hour and a half away, but already the presence of police and temporary barriers was attracting a crowd. A presentation platform had been erected above the great maze of new tram lines that had been laid, snaking silver tracks that weaved over and crisscrossed the venerable Potsdamer Platz, looking like so much steel spaghetti. It was difficult to imagine how trams from all directions could navigate them without smashing together in the middle. The platform was bedecked with flags and golden eagles, ancient symbols of military and imperial power. They were in sharp contrast to the civic banner that hung among them proclaiming Berlin Weltstadt, announcing the municipal council's proud boast that their ultra-modern capital was the first world city. Imperial and municipal. The two Berlins truly were meeting at Potsdamer Platz. And in the middle of it, set at waist height, there was a purple ribbon stretched between two golden staffs. That was where the emperor would be standing, scissors in hand. Stanton turned away. There was nothing else to see at the moment. The troops had not yet arrived. Nor had any of the dignitaries who were to sit in the little grandstand that had been erected so the great and the good might watch the Kaiser perform his snip. Stanton stared back behind him, east across Leipziger Platz to the magnificent western end of the Wertheim department store. It really was a fantastic building. The facade was stern, angular, and massively solid in grey granite. Four huge arches reached halfway up the rock face, and above that, stone pillars soared skyward to a steep, slate-tiled pelmet running around its entirety as if the building were wearing a steel helmet. In Berlin, even the department stores looked like soldiers. That shop looked solid enough to stand forever, as if nothing could dent its solidity and certitude. But Stanton knew different. He closed his eyes for a moment and conjured up the pictures he had seen of that very building in utter ruins. The gutted, burnt-out, half-smashed victim of war and revolution. That could happen. It had happened. But now it wouldn't. That shop would stand for centuries as its architect had intended, delighting generations of shoppers at the heart of a city too rich to fight. Because of what he must do that day. And it did seem as if fate was on his side this time. In fact, Stanton could scarcely believe his good fortune. Any gunman mounted on top of that steel-grey precipice would have an angle of fire that would cover Potsdamer Platz in almost its entirety, certainly the part where the Kaiser would be cutting the ribbon. The 300 metres or so between the store and the podium were open road and public plaza. There was literally nothing between where Stanton intended to place himself and his imperial target. He walked back towards the store, sweating beneath his protective vest. It was 12 noon, and a shift of shop workers had just clocked off for lunch. The road was flooded with pretty girls, all dressed in the Wertheim livery. Only a generation ago, those girls would have been peasants as their mothers and grandmothers had been, but Berlin was growing at a frantic pace. It needed workers, and it was prepared to pay. There were so many blonde heads, all bleached white gold by sun-drenched country childhoods. It was like walking through a field of daffodils. He'd save them. He'd save those girls. They'd all have husbands, and their children would have fathers because of him. Germany would survive. The better Germany.
The Germany of fabulous department stores, expanding tram networks, and bouquets of happy, pretty shop girls. The Kaiser would be gone, but this time round, he would not take Germany with him. Wertheim's was simply enormous. It boasted 83 lifts. 83! In 1914! Stanton had had no idea. If the year before anyone had asked him how many lifts the biggest shop in Berlin had before the Great War, he'd have guessed at perhaps 6 at the most. And Wertheim's wasn't even the biggest. There was Jandorf's and Tietz and, largest and newest of all, the Kaufhaus des Westens. History had always taught Stanton to think of pre-war Berlin as a sort of urban military parade ground. But in fact, it was basically all about the shopping, like a 21st century airport. Crazy with success and awash with money. Such a lot to have thrown away to please an unbalanced ruler and a few vicious old generals. Well, not this time around. Stanton stepped beneath the great front arches and entered the famed atrium. Even though he'd reconnoitred it on each of the 3 previous afternoons, it still took his breath away. It was like being inside a cathedral. A cathedral to commerce. A great glass-topped inner space reached up 5 stories to the roof. In the centre was a huge statue of a noble-looking female peasant with a harvest basket in her arms, who no doubt represented some sort of pastoral ideal. The figure was framed by twin staircases, which curled around her and led up to 5 levels of smart internal arcades, like the inside of a vast cream kuchen, each layer stuffed with perfumes and chocolates, handbags and dresses, and all sorts of luxury items. Stuff which was about as far from the pastoral ideal as it would be possible to get. Stanton headed for one of the 83 lifts. He passed the delicatessen and patisserie. More whipped cream. Lots more. He wondered why they bothered with the cake bit at all. He took the lift to the 5th floor and walked from there up to the roof garden. He wanted to be able to approach it discreetly at his own pace, not be ejected stage centre through the doors of a lift. He got out at household fittings and furniture. Great, heavy wooden cabinets and vast, double-sprung cushion settees. He wondered why they had decided to sell the largest, heaviest goods on the 6th floor. Walking at a gentle pace, his gun bag firmly gripped in his right hand, Stanton took the short stairway up onto the roof garden. It was busy, just as it had been on his previous visits. Everywhere, contented people were enjoying ices or ordering an early lunch. No Kuchen yet. They'd get into that in the early afternoon. Stanton walked purposefully across the garden. A tall, impressive, commanding figure. A figure of authority. That was the way to avoid being challenged. Look like you were in charge. Arriving at the door to the outer roof with its stern message of Verboten, he paused and nodded with evident approval, as if finding everything in order. Then he took out a notebook and pen and strode through the door. He had done exactly that on his previous 3 visits. Had any of the busy and harassed waitresses thought to question him, which he thought extremely unlikely, he would have informed them that he was an inspector on a visit of inspection. One thing he knew about Berliners was that they respected authority, and if you displayed it, you had it. As expected, he wasn't challenged. These were different times to those in which he had been brought up. Random mass terror was still a rare thing then, and the concept of homeland security didn't really exist, as had been witnessed by the woeful security arrangements made for the Archduke in Sarajevo. In London, the Prime Minister walked down Whitehall to Parliament from Downing Street every day, without a police escort. And that in a country which had the previous year been on the verge of civil war over Ireland. This was an age where if a man had the small amount of balls required to walk through a Verboten sign, he could wander around pretty much on any roof he fancied, even one that overlooked a place where the head of state was scheduled to present himself publicly. Stanton looked at his watch. The Kaiser was scheduled to make his appearance in less than an hour. The watch reminded him of Bernadette. It doesn't tick. He really loved her voice. He looked about himself. He was alone on the roof and completely unobserved. He began to make his way towards the eastern end of the building, moving from chimney to chimney, avoiding treading on air vents. He was about halfway between the roof garden and the roof ledge when he heard voices, and before he had time to take cover, two workmen appeared before him from behind an asphalt-covered ventilation shaft. Fortunately, they were more surprised to see somebody besides themselves on the roof than Stanton was, and he recovered first.
"Good morning,"
he said loudly in German, moving to place the sun behind him.
"The staff in the coffee garden informed me that there were men on the roof. Kindly explain your purpose for being here."
Again, the natural presumption of authority was the key. Had he hesitated, it was possible that the men might have challenged him. But he gave them no chance.
"We are works and maintenance," one of the men replied. "Please may I see your authorization?"
Stanton went on. Stanton could see that they were hesitating. No doubt they had performed maintenance work on the roof many times and never been challenged before. If he gave them time to think, they might just decide it was them who should be asking the questions.
"His Imperial Highness is making an appearance in Potsdamer Platz this lunchtime. I'm sure you are aware of this. The surrounding area is therefore subject to inspection. Kindly show me your authorization at once."
That did it. The men produced their time cards.
"Thank you,"
Stanton said after a cursory glance. "This is an order. Please inform me what the purpose of your work is here today."
"A couple of the girls in cushions and soft furnishings were complaining about a fluttering and banging. They thought it was a bird, which sometimes do get caught in the air vents, but we can't find anything, so either they imagined it or else it's got away."
"Or it's dead," his companion volunteered. "They sometimes just die of panic, in which case the girls'll smell it in a day or two and we'll know to take the grid off and fish it out."
"That's right,"
the first man agreed.
"Good,"
Stanton said.
"And your purpose here is finished?"
"Yes, we are done now. We was going on our break. We had thought about taking it here, sir. What with the sun and air, sir?"
Stanton noticed that the second man was carrying a vacuum flask and a small cloth-covered bundle, which he took to be their lunch.
"I'm afraid that will not be possible today. The roof must be cleared."
The two men shrugged, touched their caps, and left, exiting via a service hatch, which Stanton noted as a possible escape route should he need to make a hurried exit. When the men had gone, Stanton pondered the encounter. He didn't think it would cause him problems. After all, he intended to be back in his apartment in Mitte before the police had even deduced that the shot might have come from the top of the Wertheim store. There was no doubt that his bullet, if successful, would make a pretty big mess of the Kaiser's skull, and in the process punch the man clean off the podium. Working out an angle of trajectory from the corpse would be impossible, so the cops would only ever be able to guess at the location of the gunman. He was a very long way away, and the shot would be difficult using a gun made in 1914. It would therefore take them some time to include the Wertheim roof in their list of possibilities. If they ever did get around to interviewing the two workmen about the official who had ordered them from the roof, the trail would be long cold. It had been an unsettling moment, though, and he slipped off the safety catch of the Glock in his pocket just in case. If necessary, he would kill anyone who attempted to confront him. He was horribly aware that he only had one shot at saving the world. Alone once more, Stanton made his way to the edge of the roof. There was a small ledge from which the slate-tiled helmet of the building sloped steeply away for 3 meters or so, ending in a fringe of iron guttering that prevented him from seeing the colonnaded edifice beneath. Stanton sat down, opened the bag he was carrying, and took out the pieces of his rifle and sight. Having assembled the gun, he took off his jacket and bunched it up on the ledge as a cushion for a steady aim. Then he took stock of the scene that was now gathering in the Potsdamer Platz, 300 meters to the west. Lines of troops had now assembled, and the viewing stand was filling up. By looking through his telescopic sight, Stanton could see the faces of the dignitaries and their wives quite clearly beneath their polished top hats and fancy confections of lace and flowers. The centre of the presentation podium was still empty, but there were a number of people assembled at either end. Glancing further afield, Stanton saw that a military band was playing, the sound of which was reaching him borne on the breeze. Between the band and the podium, there was a space lined on either side with soldiers, where it was clear the Emperor's car would cross the Platz. He settled down to wait, hoping that the celebrated German efficiency would deliver the Emperor on time. In fact, he arrived a few minutes early, perhaps anxious to get such a boringly non-military function over with as soon as possible so that he could get back to his beloved parade grounds. There was a stirring in the crowd, and the rhythm of the distant music changed to what Stanton thought he recognised as God Save the King. He was momentarily taken aback before recalling having read that the German imperial anthem Heil dir im Siegerkranz used the same tune. The anthem signalled the arrival of the royal motorcade. There was much cheering and waving of hats as the middle car drew up in front of the red carpet. The small crowd, which had been swollen by the host of golden daffodils on their lunch break from the department store, were clearly enjoying the occasion. A gaggle of dignitaries scurried forward to greet the monarch. Stanton couldn't see this part of the proceedings because the royal car was in the way. He could only imagine the great man trying to look interested while the details of the new tramline pattern were explained to him. A few moments passed, and the party emerged from under the cover of the roof of the car, and the Kaiser strode up the red carpet towards the podium. Stanton viewed the scene through his gun sight, but there was no chance to get a clean shot. The monarch was leading the group, and all Stanton could see through the crowd of top hats that followed him were the ostrich plumes of his ridiculous helmet. Wilhelm was, of course, in uniform. Only he would have felt it appropriate to dress up as an admiral of the fleet or a commander of the heavy cavalry in order to open a new tram junction. The Kaiser mounted the platform. Stanton, who was already stretched out on his stomach behind the telescopic lens of his rifle, placed his finger against the trigger and took a view through the crosshairs. It was a fairly long range, so the target bobbed about considerably in the circle of his lens, but hopefully, when it arrived at centre stage, it would be still. But Stanton doubted that the Kaiser would remain still for long. The whole event was scheduled for only 15 minutes, and the Kaiser appeared to have brought no notes with him. Perhaps he would not speak at all, and simply deliver the snip. Stanton settled deeper into his firing position, the barrel of the gun resting on his folded jacket on the ledge. The Kaiser took his position in front of the ribbon and nodded. It seemed that he definitely did not intend to say anything, as an officer approached him at once carrying a cushion on which was a pair of scissors. The Kaiser took up the scissors and reached forward to cut the ribbon.
Bang!
A shot was fired. But it wasn't Stanton who fired it. Stanton felt a massive pain in his back, as if somebody had taken a clump hammer and brought it down with all their might on a space just to the right of his spine, just behind his heart. He'd been shot at, and but for the polyethylene ballistic plates in his Gore-Tex vest, he would have been dead already. Stanton let go of his rifle and rolled over. Already the Glock semi-automatic was in his hand. All in an instant, he saw a grey-clad figure with a shaven head standing 10 meters or so away with a rifle at his shoulder. The figure must have managed to cock the bolt with inordinate speed because there was another crack, and Stanton felt another horrendous blow to his chest, a ferocious steel punch from a tiny ballistic fist which left him gasping for breath. However, the body armour saved his life a second time, and despite the twin blows he'd taken on the back and front of his body, Stanton was able to bring his handgun up to the firing position and return fire. He loosed off 3 rounds in scarcely more than a second. The first missed, but the second two hit the man in the arm and upper chest, knocking him backwards against the chimney in front of which he was standing. Stanton didn't even watch his assailant fall fully to the ground. Even as the man slid down the chimney into a heap, Stanton had rolled back over onto his front. Gasping at the pain in his bruised chest, he took up his telescopic rifle once more. It had been incredible misfortune that some sort of guard had happened upon him at that time. The Kaiser's people were clearly a massive step up from the Austrians, as indeed Stanton had feared they would be. They must have decided to sweep the roofs after all. Nonetheless, as long as there weren't any more of them, he might still have time to get his man. Glancing down into the Potsdamer Platz, he realized that the whole incident with the guard had only taken a matter of seconds. The Kaiser was still cutting the ribbon. It seemed to be proving troublesome, and two officials had stepped forward to pull the thing tight to make it easier to cut. Stanton thanked the heavens for the Germans' public appetite for military bands. Gunfights make a noise, and while his own Glock was a relatively quiet piece, the two rifle shots might easily have carried as far as the podium had a brass band not been playing. They had no doubt been heard in the roof garden, but Stanton could only hope they had been ignored. There were plenty of motor cars in Berlin, and cars from that time backfired a lot. Putting all other thoughts from his mind, Stanton settled once more, and, after a moment's searching through the magnified lens, picked up his target in the crosshairs. The Emperor was standing quite alone, behind the little ribbon at the front of the stage. The dignitaries had all gathered at the edges of the podium, apart from the two holding the ribbon. Stanton was glad to see that the Kaiserin was not present. He had no wish to shoot a man in front of his wife. Now, with the Kaiser in his sights, he could see the man's face close up for the first time. It was shocking how familiar it was, even to a man born towards the end of the 20th century. That moustache, so fierce and uncompromising, the waxed and carefully arranged glory of what had at that time been the most famous whiskers on the planet. The eyes, not unkind at all, but made deliberately fierce from years of assuming a look as stern as he could make it. Stanton knew that the Kaiser had been quite friendly and considerate as a schoolboy, but later, as a guards officer and young ruler, he had deliberately cultivated an abrupt and imperious manner. He'd thought it was expected of him. Looking at the man, Stanton was also struck by his resemblance to the British royals, even the ones who had been born 100 years after him. That was one strong gene pool. And powerful. Incredibly powerful. The British king, the German Kaiser, the Russian Tsar. All first cousins. How strange the world had once been. Stanton raised the angle of his sighting by an infinitesimally small margin, bringing his crosshairs up to a point an inch above the space between the Emperor's eyes. The man was speaking now, perhaps complaining about the bluntness of the scissors, but keeping himself stiff and rigid as he did so. Formal. Proper. Dead. Stanton watched his target's head explode through the magnified lens. He had known he'd only get one shot, and so had used ammunition that was designed to do the maximum damage. And it had. As the man's body seemed to half float, half stagger backwards,
there was almost nothing left above its shoulders at all. Stanton had completed his mission. Archduke Franz Ferdinand was alive, and the Kaiser was dead. The Great War had been averted. The world had been saved. Chapter 31. Stanton dismantled his rifle and stowed it in his bag. He picked up the spent cartridge shell and stowed that also. Next, he took a second empty rifle cartridge shell from his pocket. It was for a Mauser Gewehr 98, the German army rifle of the period. He put the empty shell on the ground where his firing position had been. When the police discovered the shell, they would presume they knew the make of the murder weapon. A German gun for a fictitious German killer. His own bullet would have disintegrated. Now there was just one last element to the Kronos plan to be completed. An element Stanton found almost as distasteful as having been required to shoot an innocent man from a safe distance. This was to give the authorities someone to blame for the killing. Someone German, so that the nation would look within itself for revenge, and not abroad. Stanton couldn't fault the logic. By 1914, Germany had the most developed and the most sophisticated left wing in the world. The pace and sophistication of Germany's economic revolution had led to a huge new class of educated men and women who were more than aware of their own exploitation. The Red Scare bogeyman was alive and well in pre-war Germany, and hysterical reactionaries were ready to believe any slander against organized labor. Stanton was about to give them a bigger stick to beat them with than they could have ever dreamt of. He didn't like doing it. Blaming the left for crimes they hadn't committed was an age-old establishment sport, but it had to be done. Better a Germany fighting itself than fighting the rest of the world. Stanton took one of the leaflets from his bag and placed it under the Mauser shell case. The leaflet was bright blood red in colour. It featured a stern and noble-looking working man who was bringing his mighty fist down on the head of a vicious little devil with the face of the Kaiser. The wording on the leaflet was very simple. "The Kaiser is dead. Workers rise up and take control." That was all. No detail. Nothing more specific.
"Let 'em sweat over it,"
McCluskey had said.
"Let 'em obsess over it. Who killed Bill? The whole country will tie itself in knots."
Having left his false evidence, Stanton put on his jacket, ready to leave. He allowed himself one last glance down into Potsdamer Platz, where, not surprisingly, absolute pandemonium had broken out. The crowd had surged forward, and lines of soldiers, including the entire brass band, were struggling to keep them back, while all the top-hatted gentlemen clustered together behind the podium where the ex-emperor's body no doubt had landed. Stanton knew that he was watching the epicentre of a storm. That moment when the pebble hits the pond. Already he could see many figures scurrying not towards the tragedy, but away from it. Most of them would be police fanning out in an effort to find the perpetrator, but there would also be reporters, anxious to be the first to file the most astonishing and momentous story of the century. The undisputed ruler of the German Empire, virtual dictator of the most vibrant economy and fearsome military in Europe, had been murdered. Arguably the single most powerful man on earth was dead. Stories simply did not get any bigger. So far, the shock waves had scarcely reached the edge of Potsdamer Platz, since they were still being propelled on foot. But let the first man reach a telephone or a telegraph office, and the world would tremble at the astonishing news. Stanton turned away. He had killed the emperor less than 90 seconds before. The scene in the roof garden cafe would remain undisturbed for perhaps another 2 or 3 minutes. He wanted to be there when the news hit, not still out on the roof. He thought for a brief moment about checking on the guard he had shot. Possibly he was still alive, and if he was, there was an outside chance that the man could identify him later. Stanton decided to let it go. One cold-blooded murder was quite enough for one day. Besides, he needed to clear the scene of the crime quickly and distribute his leaflets. Having sprinted back across the roof, Stanton paused for a moment outside the Fairbourton door to collect himself, then strode through, as ever looking confident, relaxed, and in command. He doubted that anybody noticed him, but if they did, he was pretty sure the moment would not register. Why would it? The world was still the same as it had been for decades, a charmed Edwardian world, ever steady and reassuringly unchanging. That world would last about another minute. Stanton exited from the roof garden by the same door he had entered it, walking down the flight of stairs to the fifth-floor furniture department. Then he strolled casually across the floor until he came to the top of the grand staircase, which descended in gilded magnificence down 5 floors. Looking down, Stanton could see the top of the head of the female statue. It was also possible, from where he was standing, to imagine that one was squinting down inside her plaster blouse, a circumstance that had given a generation of schoolboys enormous comical pleasure. As Stanton passed the top banister, he took from his jacket another sheaf of 100 or so of the forged socialist leaflets. Scarcely breaking his stride, he balanced them on the top balustrade as he passed, and then began to walk down the stairs. He knew that they would not balance for long, and sure enough, before he had taken another 5 steps, the pages came fluttering down the great stairwell of the atrium like large pieces of red confetti. Looking down as they fluttered past him, Stanton could see that at the bottom of the 5th flight, down on the ground floor, clusters of people were gathering together and gesticulating. One woman had even swooned. Time seemed to slow down for a moment as Stanton watched the intense conversations begin to spread up the stairs as the leaflets descended to meet them. People were grabbing at the red confetti now, and as they did, there were cries of anger and horror all around. Stanton kept walking down onto the ground floor, where the shop was all of a sudden in complete uproar as everyone began to digest and protest the terrible news. Stanton pushed his way through the excited throng, through the doors of the shop, and out onto Leipziger Straße. Although it was a warm day, there was a stiff breeze blowing east across the twin plätze of Leipzig and Potsdam. Stanton turned west, and as he did so, he plunged his hand into his bag where the rest of his leaflets were hidden. In one confident movement, he drew them out and dropped them to the pavement. Then he just kept walking, not looking back even once. He didn't need to. He knew that behind him the red leaflets would be gusting across the tramlines towards where the Kaiser's corpse no doubt still lay. Stanton's mission was complete. As the adrenaline rush of the previous hour began to subside, he had leisure to realize that he was finding breathing a little painful. Putting his hand to his chest, he felt the rough quality of singed cloth, and remembered for the first time since leaving the roof that he had been shot at 2x. Glancing down, he saw a black burn mark on his tweed jacket right in front of his heart. He knew there would be identical damage on the back of his jacket, again right in front of his heart. That guard had been a bloody good shot. It seemed German police training was as efficient as their army and their industry. Stanton took off the jacket and folded it over his arm. Better to be out in shirt sleeves than displaying what might be recognized as bullet holes in your clothing. Stanton probed gently at his chest and back as he walked, wincing when his fingers applied any pressure. He was badly bruised, there was no doubt about that, and would certainly be an ugly colour in the morning. But nothing was broken. So far, his luck had held. If it changed now, it didn't matter. He'd already saved the world.
Chapter 32. Stanton took a walk down Unter den Linden and went for lunch in the Tiergarten. Bratwurst, mustard, and a stein of beer. A typically German meal to celebrate the private knowledge that by what he had just done, he had preserved a better Germany for the century to come. That Germany of contented, progressive people who were more fond of beer and sausage than conquest and murder. The Germany the previous 20th century had corrupted. The Tiergarten had been quiet and rather sedate when he had walked through it previously, but now it was full and what would in another age be called buzzing. The news of the Kaiser's death was crashing through the city like cannon fire, and as Stanton sat at his lunch, it occurred to him that he was watching a city becoming collectively traumatized. All around him, hundreds of identical conversations were occurring as the news was shared. Nannies with their charges, wide-eyed with shock. Portly gentlemen waving their arms in horror. Earnest students, tight-lipped and grim. Each had been going about his or her business, strolling through the park, chatting to friends, pondering some private thought, only to overhear a comment or join a conversation and be suddenly transformed. Their faces turning in an instant to blank bewilderment and utter horror. If it were possible for an entire city to go into shock, that was what was happening to Berlin. Nobody in that city was ever going to forget what they were doing when they heard the news that the Kaiser had been assassinated. Stanton felt a little uncomfortable, almost like a voyeur spying on someone else's sorrows. That sensation brought to mind his own personal isolation and loneliness. He was still on the outside, still emotionally unconnected with the world in which he was living, in which he would always live now. Nonetheless, that loneliness was tinged with elation. It came upon him in little waves. The world historical task with which he had been entrusted was over, and he had done his duty. And he had done what a million British soldiers had dreamt of doing. He'd killed the Kaiser. On that thought, he decided to order another beer, but discovered that he'd been lucky to get the first. On hearing the momentous news, the owners had quickly concluded that serving beer and sausage wasn't an appropriate thing to do on such an afternoon. The waiters were at that moment closing the little entrance gate to their tea garden and telling the customers that they were shutting up indefinitely out of respect for the fallen emperor. Stanton decided to return to his apartment. This wasn't his grief, his trauma. He might have caused it, but he was not of it. His had been a clinical action. Theirs was a guttural reaction. By dying, the Kaiser had brought the whole city together far more completely than he had ever done in life. But Stanton wasn't part of it. He had a bottle of raspberry-flavoured schnapps waiting in his room and some Liebfraumilch wine, keeping cool wrapped in a wet undershirt. He had laid these in anticipation of not quite knowing what to do with himself after the event, so he decided to go home, get a little drunk, and once more consider his future. A future that was finally his to consider. On his way back to Mitte, he noticed that it wasn't just the cafes in the Tiergarten that were closing their doors. The whole city was shutting down. Remembering that he had no food at all in his room, he darted into a little grocer on a corner of the Alexanderplatz just before they closed their doors. He was lucky to get in. Otherwise, he would have had no supper and probably no breakfast either. He bought bread, cheese and ham, biscuits and some peaches, which would keep him going till the city opened up again.
He knew the store. He'd shopped there before, and he recognised the young woman who was serving behind the till. On the previous day, when he'd bought some summer fruits from her, he had been rather charmed because she smiled so broadly and sang softly to herself while she measured out the strawberries. It had been a song about Erdbeer being sweet, but not as sweet as love. Today, however, there were no smiles and no singing. The girl had been crying so hard she could barely count out his change.
"Our Kaiser is with God now," she said,
before adding,
"and may God curse whoever did this."
She was cursing him. It was a strange feeling. The grocer's girl wasn't the only one who was weeping and cursing. Leaders are always more popular in death, and there were many on the streets unable to contain their emotions. Stanton saw one old woman beating her breast in despair. He'd never imagined anybody actually did that. He thought it was just some old-fashioned phrase from the days of melodrama, but this woman was actually pummeling at her chest in a kind of paroxysm of grief, while another woman tried to comfort her. Those who weren't openly crying just looked drawn and grim, as if they were forcing back tears. There wasn't a single person who was not obviously and deeply affected by what was clearly being seen as a national tragedy of previously undreamt of proportions. Stanton had expected as much, of course, but the intensity still took him by surprise. He made his way back to his street and let himself into his building. The outer door opened into a little vestibule and stairwell where an old concierge sat. He was a taciturn man who had never said anything to Stanton beyond a brief Morgen or Abend. On this afternoon, however, the man felt moved to speak.
"Bastards," he spat as Stanton greeted him. "Those swine, those vermin, those Untermensch, we'll hang them all."
"Who?" Stanton asked. "Who will you hang?"
"The socialists, of course," he answered, "and the anarchists with them, those revolutionary scum."
"Well, first the police have to catch them, don't they?" Stanton reminded the man.
"We know where they are,"
the old concierge replied darkly.
"They can't hide."
Stanton went up to his little room, laid out his food for later, and opened his bottle of wine. He drank a glass straight down, toasting himself in the mirror above his washbowl. Now was the time to look again at the list he'd begun that morning. Shackleton, Everest, Fly the Atlantic, Soldiering, Bernadette. Now, at last, he could move on. But at that moment, he found he couldn't even begin to move on. For some reason, he felt no sense of completion whatsoever. He was as all at sea as he'd felt in those first moments when he had found himself apparently alone in the cellar in Istanbul, the taste of the half-naked Turkish girl's spearmint lip gloss still on his lips. Drinking deep at his wine, he tried to put this feeling of unease down to the fact that he had killed someone that day. That was a terrible thing to have to do, and any man who remained unmoved by such a thing should never be trusted with a gun. Stanton had killed before, of course, but not very often, and he'd found that it never got any easier. But that was just the natural human horror at taking a life. He didn't regret it. Far from it, in fact. He was absolutely confident in his mind that he'd acted for the right reasons and done the right thing. If he had to do it again, he would. So why did he feel so unsettled? Seeking comfort, he took a book from his bag. A book he had brought with him from the future, and which also, because of him, would never now be written. It was the collected poems of Wilfred Owen. a favourite of Stanton's since he was a boy. He'd read those poems many times since arriving in the past, because he could think of no better argument for his mission than those harrowing but infinitely moving chronicles of quiet heroism, appalling carnage, and pointless sacrifice. Owen's heartfelt verse described more poignantly than any statistics ever could the nightmare that Stanton was preventing. It had given Stanton great strength to know that Owen would write different poems after his mission was complete. That instead of dying in a great and terrible war, Wilfred Owen would instead get his chance to live. And Brooke, and Sassoon, and millions of other brave young men whose lives were equally important, though their names had only ever been celebrated on neglected war memorials in town and village squares. But that afternoon, with his wine and his schnapps and the great German warmonger dead, he found the poems didn't help. The troubled and uncomfortable feeling that had been growing in him since first he had emerged from the Wertheim store wasn't to do with him doubting the validity of his mission. It was just that he felt uneasy. Things were getting noisier outside now. Stanton's window was open because of the warmth of the afternoon, and it was beginning to sound as if the entire population of Berlin was spilling out onto the streets. And if people were still weeping outside, then the sound of it was drowned out by other noises, less peaceful ones. There were shouts and chanting and the occasional sound of breaking glass. Also, there were clanging bells, whistles and klaxons as the authorities spread their net, hunting for a killer they would never find. Sitting listening to it all in his apartment, the Liebfraumilch tasting bitter for all its sweetness, Stanton sensed madness in the air. He'd experienced something very similar before. In Kabul, when an American drone aircraft had gone out of control and crashed down onto a school, destroying it totally. The Afghan people had flooded onto the streets then, just as they were doing in Berlin now. It had been a bad time to be an American, or indeed a Westerner of any kind. Stanton and his comrades had barricaded themselves into their compound and sat it out for days with their safety catches off. It was socialists whom the crowd was seeking this time, but Stanton suspected that the hatred would be just as general and arbitrary. "Death to socialists!" he could hear them chant through his open window. "Hang them all!" That was the message. All of them. Not just the guilty ones, but all of them. Leaning out of his window, he saw people brandishing the early editions of the evening papers. He went downstairs and bought one himself. The grim, black-trimmed headline adhered to the elegantly verbose standards of the day. There was no "Kaiser dead," as would have been the case in Stanton's own age. Instead, the headline ran, "His Imperial Highness is assassinated in Berlin. Socialist conspiracy is suspected." Stanton felt a thrill at that. This was, after all, the first historic front page of a new and different 20th century. He found himself thinking how one day the very headline he was looking at would be reproduced digitally in documentaries on the television in some other version of his own age. But there was certainly going to be a price to pay. The mood in the street was getting angrier. Strangers were exchanging rumours that the police had uncovered a massive leftist conspiracy to overthrow the government. Stanton heard people speaking confidently about hundreds of revolutionaries and anarchists who had been poised to seize control. Over and over again, he heard the word revenge.
This ends Disc 8.